I don't worry my head under the toque. It's your turn to die while I replace. Good day to all of you. And this is about displacement.
Yeah, yeah, and appropriation.
Appropriation. The railway stop existed between Cranberry Portage and La Palme, Manitoba. Mm-hmm. Again, straight out of my experience.
I like this. Mm-hmm. That's a good line, because you evade the stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
I don't commit suicide, or I drink. Mm-hmm. That's the stereotype of the drinking, alcohol drinking.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
River water, because the river is polluted. And who polluted it?
Mm-hmm.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. You have to pay attention.
Yeah.
That's paying attention.
Yeah.
I heard you don't die because you want to be forever young, and you don't want to be replaced. You don't want to have children.
Mm-hmm.
That's white society.
Yeah.
You don't want to die, but you don't want to be replaced either. it's a dichotomy. I can't picture it.
It's. I think it's despair. Well, we've come to, if we continue in our ways, the way we've been for hundreds of years, that road is leading towards death. And some people anticipate that. And that's why they stop reproducing.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
And they don't look at the environment.
Or you feel bad having children because you as an adult haven't managed, although you're struggling, to clean it up for them and make it safe.
Mm-hmm.
So people despair.
Yes, I suppose that's exactly, you know, where
and they
I
may
see.
Not articulate it.
Mm-hmm. And yes, yeah, so that's a good point. But I also have this other message, and I came to say, see, sailing on. See, it's our boat called Sailing On. We are refugees from the land of hurt. None of us planned this trip, and none of us knew of this boat. We arrived at the dock together this afternoon. See, it's not well built. It's made from everything and anything. Maybe it's meant to sink. Let's get on. Maybe we can touch souls. Maybe we can touch faces. The healing to start. See, it floats. You are so familiar. You're so like myself. I'm not here to take you away. I can talk to you. When you get there, when we get there, will you walk me to wherever I must go? Nowhere fancy. A quiet corner I can share with you. See the solid line? The horizon? No, that's no longer my life's goal. I can talk to you, fellow refugee from the land of hurt. It's more than I've done for years and years. Mm-hmm. So, again, you're trying to evoke a voyage, and you're trying to say, you are no different from me.
Mm-hmm.
And if we want to analyze that, can we do it in the middle of a noisy place? I don't think so.
No.
So this is, it will be done in contemplation, but it will be done in exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not done that for more than, you know, for years and years. And I said the poem was inspired by From Boulder to Birmingham, written by Emmylou Harris and Bill Danoff, sung by Emmylou Harris.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
Where she said, I'm watching the cannon burn.
Yeah.
And I'm listening to the highway sing.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to those words, her words, and then you begin to see, what is she really saying?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is it she talking about love, or is she talking about a voyage?
Mm-hmm.
So I get my inspiration from, you know, many right through life, and I don't reject whatever it is that can influence me. And
how do you feel, I always ask this, about, well, I told you about this project that I'm hoping to get done. Right now I'm really bogged down with teaching a lot, so I don't really get the research done that I'd like to do, and the writing. How do you feel about that, if somebody, an outsider like myself, puts together an anthology? Is that an appropriation?
That's not, putting together an anthology is not an appropriation, because you are using the words of the people. You are not saying this is something that I learned, and this is the way I see it.
No, I certainly wouldn't say
that. No, what you are saying, this is, if you said this is the way I understand it, this is the way I've assimilated it, and I think this is what these people are trying to say. I think this is what they're trying to say. You are saying you are giving yourself a cell, almost a spot. I am standing here, but these people are standing here, and I am just trying to see what it is they're trying to say. And this is the way I see it.
Okay,
this way I understand.
Yeah, that's how I understand it too. Otherwise, I couldn't do it. But,
an anthology is
different.
Not an appropriation.
Well, that is an issue that was contended by some people very strongly.
Anthologies and on top of anthology on top of anthology, where you have, let's say, almost like a critical mass of different, let's say, different natives of 20 writers who could immediately produce their own anthology, but you ask them to do it, etc., and then you go on to add that to your resume as an editor of these, and it has happened. What has happened is typos have appeared in the original scripts, and very little work had to be done. But it adds to your prestige.
Yeah, that's true. It does. It does. It does to theirs too, because they're published.
Yeah, and we are saying the challenge is that we have to be more careful who does the anthology, that they do a damn good job, that they're good editors, that they pay attention to even the way they put things together. And I think that's their responsibility. What you have to say to yourself is, well, who is this person? Why does he want to put an anthology together? If he wants to do it for there are people in this country, it's who say, well, okay, I'll get 3,000 poets, and I will get $1 from each of them, and I will produce an anthology. And you know nothing about poetry, but you hire an editor, and then you, or nothing about short stories, and you put, this is the kind of person I'm very wary of. I'm also wary of the person who becomes an expert after a couple of years of reading this kind of material. I'm
gonna leave these here for a few minutes. Put them down so not such a wall there.
Thank you.
So anyway, it's been really, for me, we are learning too.
Everybody's learning.
We are learning. This is a whole new field.
This was good to me.
But it's exciting. There's no doubt for me, which is very exciting.
I've used tape recordings like this before in classrooms. In Germany, I teach classes on minority literatures in North America, on native literature. And sometimes it's very good if we, for example, read a novel like Slash, and then I've got a tape recording with something that Jeanette Armstrong said, or some readings. So would you have objections if I used this here?
Oh, absolutely not.
And if I use it like that, is there something you'd like to say to young people in Germany, students?
I think whenever you approach the Nobel Prize is given to all kinds of people writing in all kinds of languages. So there are bodies of literature that you are never going to come across except in translation.
That's right. Yeah.
You can only hope you have a good translator. You can only hope to have a good transcriber. But when people are writing from their tradition and they're now transcribing, we have what I call the responsibility to be faithful, to write even as we're writing fiction, to write as close to the truth as possible, that we don't put things in there that are foolish, that make the people appear stupid, that if it's not teaching something, that it at the same time, what we have in this country is an untapped humor is not totally untapped. We haven't gone into that section as yet. There is so much of it among the native people, and I'm just literally bursting, wanting to write in that vein. And I realize that to be funny is to be very, is a very hard task. Because you're transcribing. So that is something I'm going to have to look at. To be serious, you can be. To be, when you are serious like this, you become, you begin to measure your tones. So for students, when they hear somebody like myself speak, listen to how I start my sentence and how I stop it. You will hear something. Just pay close attention. And from there, you might have an idea of what kind of a person I am. Once you have an idea of what kind of person I may be, you begin to understand what kind of people I've come from. And I hope I am a good representative of my people, because their investment in me was one of time, in very difficult situations. They brought me through sickness. They brought me through water, literally, ice water. They brought me through times when it was horribly cold. My mother sewed my moccasins, my shoes. She sewed everything for us. My father hunted in the dead of winter. So I am a commodity that is hard won. And I am a very important person in my family. Often this has been a tragedy in native people, among the native people, that they were not important enough to their families, that there's something vital was lost. People like myself, we were so privileged that I had grandfathers, that I had aunts, uncles in the family circle to give me that sense of place. Consequently, if I bring anything to literature, it would be that sense of place. And I hope it comes through in my voice and in the writing. And one of my daughters has learned German in university. And it is because of this interest of hers, she has gone to Belgique. And she also is looking to understand peoples. She comes from 6 different nations, from 4 races. And when I think of my daughter, who's taking a liberal arts education, she will have been in school now 5 years before she gets her degree. What I see is a young woman striving to understand herself. So when students listen to me, they're not only trying to understand me, they're trying to understand their reaction to me. We should analyze that. And should something be amiss, should they feel something is not right, they should analyze that. Maybe it's them, maybe it's me. And that's, I think that's the purpose of going to, you know, for higher education. I think that's what I should say.
Okay.
I think there's food out there too.
Okay. I was going to tell you a story.
Go ahead. No, you tell me a story. Okay. Go ahead. I love stories.
It's from, you were talking about sense of place. And the town I was born at is Rendsburg. It was founded on an island in the river. And that river is the old border between Denmark and Germany.
Cumberland House is an island.
A little down the river, the river's called the Eider, there's this ferryman, which was long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, I guess he had his cottage on the south side of the river. And one night he heard this funny sound on his window.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, almost like rain or a hailstorm or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the window probably was pigskin scraped.
Mm-hmm.
And otherwise it was wattles and mud, the cabin and thatched roof. People still have thatched roofs there. And it's very good, it insulates well. And he woke up and he heard the sound and thought, that's funny. And then he went back to sleep and there was the sound again. So he got up and he opened the door. First he didn't see anything. It was fairly light outside, although it was in the middle of the night. And then he looked down and he saw these tiny lights extending all the way like a long snake towards the south.
Mm-hmm.
It's very flat country there.
Mm-hmm.
Could see it all along to the horizon. And then he bent a little closer. And these little flickering lights, then he realized they were torches and lanterns of the little people.
Mm-hmm.
There was a whole exodus of little people.
Mm-hmm.
And they had everything. They had their carts, oxen, the cattle, pigs, the old ones and little ones.
Mm-hmm.
They were all packed up. So he bent down because they had little voices too, and he asked them what they wanted. And he said, they said, but take us over. And he said, I can't do this. You're so many. Oh, you can do it. Try it. You can do it. And then he worried because his life depended on this, his livelihood. He said, how are you going to pay me? Oh, don't worry about that. We'll pay you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he thought, well, there's so many, but I'll give it a try. So he started and he loaded up his boat and they came more and more in the boat. There was not that much between the rim of the boat and the water.
Mm-hmm.
It was filled up with like a load of light.
Mm-hmm.
He took it over the river.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went back for the next load. He kept that on all night, night, going back and forth. And then it was getting pretty light in the east already.
Mm-hmm.
Then he took the last load across, and the snake got shorter and shorter.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got the last load on the north side. He looked, and there was this ribbon of light sort of disappearing, fading into this is marshlands, the moors there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really tired then, so he got into his boat, went back.
Mm-hmm.
And then he went to his cabin. And he, because it was so warm, he'd taken off his cap.
Mm-hmm.
And when he bent to pick it up, there was tiny lights in there, so they all put little pieces of gold or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they never came back.
Mm-hmm. Tremendous story.
That's a sad story. The little people fleeing up north.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it must have been around 800 after Christ, 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And the people were Christianized up there, forcefully.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other stories about the giants throwing rocks at church towers because they couldn't stand the ringing of the bells.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of my favorite stories about the ferryman.
Yeah, because the ferryman, it invokes a memory. It invokes a memory of the. Again, of your memory. He's a memory bearer.
Mm-hmm.
And what he does is he remembers a people that are not like ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they existed.
Very important. Actually, I think they're still there.
Yeah.
Of course, there are other stories about individual little ones.
Uh-huh.
And they're a bit like coyote.
Well, they're wonderful. They're wonderful stories because the little people as if you ever have a chance, go up to Nestaway Falls.
Mm-hmm.
And there you will hear something in the night and feel something in the night, because as early as 1820,
mm-hmm.
George Nelson traveled through there,
mm-hmm.
and my own family traveled. There's in the log books of the of the Hudson Bay, some of my people passed through there.
Mm-hmm.
And there are trails through the bush along the Nestaway, just below Nestaway Falls, or just above Nestaway Falls, that you realize are really ancient. And as you spend time in this place, you begin to enter a different realm of reasoning.
Mm-hmm.
Your life just slows right down. You become another person.
Where is that?
And that's in Lac La Ronge,
oh, yeah.
Northern
mm-hmm,
Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
And because it's that kind of a place, it's like magic. It's like a magical kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And even the trees are like magic. And we took photographs of them, and you could see where the stories come from. Because the trees overlap,
mm-hmm.
and they're full of moss.
Mm-hmm.
And they have different colors at different times of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And you could begin to see shadows, almost like little people, close to the ground, and sometimes you see a great
mm-hmm.
big tree which just comes out at you in
mm-hmm.
like a big giant.
Mm-hmm.
And you could see that these are the stories that, you
mm-hmm.
know, manifest itself. It's a wonderful place, but you could see why these stories are told,
mm-hmm.
because they're so much a part of our subconscious.
Yeah.
And you know, like I said, I think to be a storyteller is to be a privileged person.
Mm.
And at the same time, if we are going to see it as an art form, you have to be a person who obeys that muse, as they say. You have to obey it. And at the same time, you have to look at the language and to see that it obeys you,
mm-hmm.
because it has to say what you want
mm-hmm.
to say.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a better word, use it.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's a simpler word, use it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very tricky. I'm finding that I have to work.
You know, there's something that some storytellers do, and I call that baiting the audience.
Baiting,
you know, yeah,
yeah,
baiting. It's like a fish hook after a while.
Oh,
yes, I've got them all. And then they sort of almost pull you in, and you think, are we coming to the close? And then they say, well, you know, that was
mm-hmm.
oh, that was the year. And they may ask somebody in the audience which year was it, and meander off and say, God, please go on.
They got
I love
you.
That, and they enjoy it too, because
oh yeah, oh yeah, I do it constantly.
I like
yeah, my
a very good friend of, or two friends of. Mine. One is Lance Henson. He's a Southern Cheyenne poet,
mm-hmm.
and he's a fantastic storyteller. And he can do that even in Germany to a German audience in English.
Mm-hmm.
He just sit there and just dead quiet. And he said, "Oh, and by the way, we tease a lot, and you're in for it." And then he goes off, and everybody says, "Come on,
tell the story, Dan, tell the story."
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think this is what my uncle, one of my uncles, his name is Bill. Uncle Bill McKenzie.
Mm-hmm.
He was a consummate storyteller, and he's the one who used to come and tell me stories. So one day, I was 3 years old during the war, and I had eaten an orange, and I was so sick
mm-hmm.
that I decided I was going to die. So I told my mother, please put me in my wicker rocking chair and give me my blanket and give me my doll, because if I'm going to die, this is where I want to die. So I'm sitting there in front of the front of the stove dying. And my uncle came in, and I told him, I said, Uncle, I'm dying. And I'm sitting in front of the stove to make sure I'm warm while I'm dying. So in being warm while I'm dying, he said, okay, I have a story to tell you. And in telling me the story, I forgot I was going to die.
I like the idea of sitting by a stove to be warm when you're dying.
Yes, that was the idea.
So there was some hope in you.
Oh yeah,
you
there
know?
Was hope in me. Totally, that you know somebody was going to rescue me, and
yeah.
it was my uncle, because he was able to tell me
mm-hmm.
the story, and I forgot,
mm-hmm.
forgot my illness.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the power of storytelling.
Yeah.
It made me forget how ill I was. And it had to do with an orange. It started with me eating an orange at a time when we had no, you know, fruit that was very scarce. And many times I used to sit by the stove, again sitting by the stove early in the morning, and he used to pass by our house. I would say by 8:30 he would already be coming from where he had been and passing by our house for his second cup of tea, and my mother would have it there for him. And he was on his way back, on his way home, and he was still 20 minutes from home. So he came to visit his sister, have tea with her, and then he would say, "What's the matter?" I say, "Oh God, I'm too sleepy and I don't want to go to school." He said, no, don't worry about that. He said, "Your sleepiness will pass, and but in the meantime," he said, "while you're sleeping and you don't want to move, I'll tell you a story." And he would tell me the story and he'd suck me in completely. I forgot how sleepy I was. I forgot how grumpy I was. I forgot I didn't want to go to school. And next thing I knew, I said, "My God, I'm late. Where are my clothes? I got to go to school." So this again was the magic of words. And the other thing I have to say is that my father decided we were going to have films in our village. So from the time I was 7 years old and 8 years old, we had paid 5 cents once a week to go to the movies. And we had the projector. And they had a generator. It was run by the Canadian Legion. And my father said, "I'm going to bring in quality movies." And everybody wanted cowboy stuff. But once a month, I would get to choose a good movie. Consequently, I saw Casablanca. I saw all these wonderful stories. Again, appreciating another medium, another well-told story. Realizing all the time this is what it was about. And the commentary that used to come from the people during the story would be really funny. At times they said, "I saw that rock in last week's movie." They began to recognize the scenery. And my aunt...
Hollywood isn't that big after all.
Hollywood wasn't that big after all. And my aunt would say, "You damn fool, can't you see what she's doing to you? She's telling you lies." She'd make these comments in the same way that they say that Negro people...
Can't you see?
They would get
That's
so
like
involved.
A performance for kids. They get carried away. "Watch out!"
And they would just be, or they would have a running commentary during a very important scene. And then you knew it was a lousy movie. And
I'll tell you another one. When I was 10, I guess, 10 or between 9 and 11, I would say. My best friend in school, he was a farmer's son, he was from the farm. And they were really very, very hardworking people all day, just a family farm. And I would go there very often, and later on take my bike out there. It was only about 10 miles. And they were about the first people that I knew who had television. And they had this. And in the evening, that we would all sit in front of them. And there would be the grandmother, his father, his sister, his mother, he and myself. And once they showed Hamlet. And I remember we were so spellbound. There's the scene with the skull. Now these people, they'd never read Shakespeare or anything. They were not by whose standard, whatever, they were not very well educated. And it was in German, it was in the translation. Here was this guy talking to the skull, and we were so spellbound. And all of a sudden, I don't know what made it, I woke up and I realized that I had tears running down my cheeks. I turned around, and normally his father, as soon as the news were gone, he was sitting on the couch, he would just go off because he was so tired, he was working all day. Everybody was awake, and the grandmother and the mother, they were all crying. I was... And I always use that when I teach classes now, and I get all these kind of, "Oh, Shakespeare."
No.
I say, "Well, there must be something for this guy if he can make that happen."
Chaucer.
No, Oh, it's older than that even. It's Danish.
So here you are, looking
at
another, and aren't you glad somebody sat down and wrote? The Canterbury Tales. I mean, I'm just studying them, and I'm just
It's even older. What's it called?
Going back to the Bible, for heaven's sake.
No, in it's a Danish Dana Gestorum, the from the history of Denmark, the Hamlet. So it's older than that. But this was the Shakespeare version. In Germany. And Chaucer and the Gesta Danorum, they don't have the graveyard scene.
No. But what I was trying to say.
Here we are competing. This was an academic.
Yeah.
No, it's that. And got the sources right. I'm sorry about that.
But again, this is what I came full, almost full circle to, is what fascinates me in that tradition. Again, is the ability to tell a good story.
Sure.
So in each tradition, there's an ability to tell a really good story, and whichever form you want to take. I mean, I grew up, I suppose, to some extent, in listening to Hemingway. Listening to Hemingway, rather hearing about Hemingway, because media really started to pay attention to Hemingway because he was a rather flamboyant character.
Yeah.
But then I read The Old Man, I think The Old Man and the Sea, and I began to see the power of this man and in the power of the understatement, and I began to see an undertow. That it's possible to have an underlying theme. And that too is very, very, very powerful. There's the obvious, of course, the obvious, and then there's the understatement.
Oh, yeah.
And these, if you're a student of literature, has to really pay attention. And because of the kind of analysis I guess I am doing at the university right now, at the undergraduate level, I am beginning to see, because I'm already writing, because I've already done all the oral, been through the oral, and because I still like to hear a good story, I am beginning to appreciate the kind of critical analysis I am forced to do in order to get my grades. I am not always successful, sometimes I'm totally wrong, but even that I appreciate, because at least I have attempted to understand the story. And if I am mistaken, then I am told, no, you look at it from this point of view. And that, to me, is very, is enhancing, I suppose, to my understanding of the story. And again, going back to, then, you know, if you look at the Nobel, the way they hand out the literature prizes or Nobel prizes all together, you never know who really is going to get it in what language and from whom. So you begin to realize that, you know, the full power. I'm thinking of the other writers too. I've been, you know, more or less in touch with. I'm thinking of Carl Jung, who's a very a very popular. Carl Jung, Dreams.
Carl Gustav Jung, the analytical psychologist.
Yes.
You see, I read a lot of Jung. I also read a lot of Freud. I'm biased against Jung. You see, at one time he was swept away and he talked about the Semitic collective unconscious and the non-Semitic collective unconscious. And I can't forgive him for that. He was in Switzerland. He was safe. He needn't have catered to Nazism that much.
To me, I'm not really worried. The only thing that we are interested in as native people of Jung, his attention to dreams.
Oh yes, oh yes.
So this is the only thing, and this passing on of the ancestral, we don't know what it is that it gets passed on to us in terms of memory in the cells, and what is released. I think some of us are born with memory. This is my honest feeling, that the template is there, and it starts, perhaps, I don't know how it works, but somehow it's there, because something will be evoked in my memory and I will think I recognize deja that.
Deja vu.
Deja vu. And it happens to me a heck of a lot. Less and less as I get older. But when I was young, I would be transfixed by a moment. And I would not know where it came from.
Yeah.
And I think the other writer who pays attention to that is Thomas Merton. He does pay attention to it in his writings, where at different times he has felt, gee, I've been here before. But what is it about this moment that makes it feel that way? And he would analyze it, and then he would work through it. And he said, no, I've never been here in any other circumstances. In a similar circumstances, but this is definitely not the place. And then it will reveal itself at another time, what happened in that moment. So, you know, there have been many, many occasions like that in my life.
Yeah, yeah, I've got that too.
And I've been very lucky to have had wonderful storytellers. I lived 3 years in Trinidad.
Mm-hmm.
And right next door to us, the tradition of that family was to tell stories in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
So grandmother would lie down on the hammock and we'd all sit in boxes, you know, that they had. They were very poor. And they would just start telling stories. And sometimes they would bring the harmonium over and they would play their East Indian music on the harmonium. And there I was able to see, again, the power of the story. And you have to have very good practitioners.
Mm-hmm.
And people would come from all over the Malu village.
Mm-hmm.
And they would come and tell their story. And they would, you know, talk about their memories, etc. It was just very moving. I cannot forget how that worked and appreciated. I always appreciate when somebody tells me a story. That's the other thing, appreciation. You really have to pay homage to the storyteller. That is something I can remember this, I think in Casablanca, I said to myself, I appreciate the actress and her ability to be able to say in her tone, play it again. And I said to myself, what is it in her voice that says something to me in my heart? When she says, play it again, what is she saying to him? And I start to imagine all kinds of things.
Yeah.
So this is where short sentence, but the way she says it, all of a sudden I begin to appreciate something, some another aspect of storytelling. And I guess I use that in the performance whenever we linger over a phrase or bring it out in a totally different way. Okay.
Thank you. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you for taking the time.
I'll have another try at that phone call now.
Yeah. Oh my goodness, I really can't.